Imagine getting a call from one of the most innovative and richest entrepreneurs in the world and telling him you don't want to work with him. Well, that's exactly what Mitch Free did.
I received another call from Jeff Bezos, you know, the Amazon founder, and he said, I love your story. I love that you've bootstrapped it. I love that you understand this manufacturing industry from the ground up, getting your hands dirty in it from day one. And you're, so you're uniquely prepared at the right moment in time. And I see these perfect storms when they happen, and this is one of them. And he said, so why don't you want to be in business with me?
Also on this week's episode, we discuss the importance of taking risks, getting your hands dirty, and chasing your passion. And now, episode one of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have the manufacturing maverick himself, Mitch Free. Mitch is a serial entrepreneur, innovator, global trade expert, and digital manufacturing expert. He currently serves as the founder and chairman of two digital manufacturing companies, Fast Radius and Zeki CNC Machining. Mitch also founded MFG.com in 2000 and served as CEO and chairman until 2013. A dynamic and sought-after presenter, he has spoken in Northwestern University, Harvard Business School, Wharton, the Society of Manufacturing Engineers, and appears regularly on various media outlets, including CNBC and Fox Business. Mitch is a previous winner of the prestigious Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award and has been featured in a number of books and publications. With that being said, I would like to welcome Mitch Free to the show. Mitch, thanks for coming on the show today.
Justin, great to have me. Always good to hang out with you.
So over the next hour or so, I'd like to provide our listeners with some insight into not only your journey and highlight some of your successes, but really more importantly, the challenges and hardships you faced and how these pivotal moments and hurdles made you who you are today and led to your success. For those who may not be familiar with you or your story, can you give them a little bit of background on where it all started?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I grew up in the South in Atlanta, right here where we're doing the podcast. And, you know, I grew up as a Southern boy, and I had to work hard to lose that really, really deep Southern accent. I know I've still got one, but not quite as bad as it once was. And, you know, so I'll fast forward to college. That was a 3-week stint. And so finally, I had this dream in my life being an engineer. I loved working on my cars and different things. And I thought, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to be an engineer, I'm going to design the coolest car. And I got to college, and it was a slap in the face. And the reason was I just hadn't learned to study. That elementary school, high school had come so easy for me. I didn't have to study. I put a little bit of effort in. I made straight A's. And then I got to college, boom. Couldn't do it. Or, so I thought, okay, fine. I'm just going to withdraw. I'm going to regroup, and I'll start college again the next semester. Now I know what it's about. I'll focus.
When you withdrew, was that a conversation that you had with your family, and were they supportive of it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they were necessarily supportive of, but I think they said, well, you know, if you're failing, you better do something, right? What's the point? So I said, no, let me just regroup. I'll get my head in the right place. I'll go back. Well, In the meantime, it started hitting me that I just didn't know that college was for me, right? So I decided before the next semester started, I would go and I would explore trade school. So I went to a local trade school, and I went in there, and this was in the 80s. And at that time, computers were just, you know, the hot thing, PCs coming on the market. And so I said there, went there, and I said, hey, I'm interested in checking out the computer repair class, of which, thank God, I didn't go that career path. And they go, well, that's full, but let us show you where we have some openings. And they showed me some. They showed me this one class called manufacturing technology, which was another word for machine shop. And I never even heard of it before. But it was cool. People were in there working with metal, making things. And I said, you know what, I think I'm going to do this. So put me in that class, the metalworking machine shop class. Put me in there until something opens in the computer class. Then I'll switch. Well, fast forward. This was a one-year course. About 6 months into it, they came and said, you know, something's now open in the computer course. And I said, oh, screw that. So I was halfway done with this one. I like it. And so I finished up in the manufacturing technology machining course. Wasn't something I ever would have planned because it just wasn't on my radar that I even knew about. But I found it really cool to get to take pieces of blocks of metal or aluminum and make very high precision complex geometries with these. It challenged my math skills, my geometry skills, strategic thinking. You think about how you're going to start something and, you know, and make it so you don't work yourself into a corner, how you're going to hold it. And I was fascinated. I found a passion.
Do you feel like that fluke or change in course indirectly was that pivotal moment or that shift in your life that put you on this journey?
I think it was one of many, okay. But I absolutely think I discovered something that I wasn't familiar with, and put me into a career path that I feel like was right in my lane. It was what I was meant to do, and I discovered it by accident. And maybe with my desire to try to go to school and be an engineer, I think it was this was a manifestation for that, but more in a hands-on, practical kind of way, of which I learned, or I figured out. That's what matches my learning style. I learn by doing. I learn by getting my hands dirty, not by reading, not by having someone tell me.
You know, to kind of play off that, that brings up an interesting point. College is something I find very fascinating. A perfect example, take yourself. I feel like there's certain people who are just not cut out for school and education in some regards. And there's a number of times you hear about a person going to college and they're either bored or they're not happy, they're not succeeding or even failing out. However, then they find something they're passionate about and it's as if something hasn't necessarily been tapped into yet. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's a great topic. And I think, you know, invest in your interest is probably the right answer that I would lean toward. I'm sure not everyone necessarily agree. But I look at college as, you know, thinking about it from where I sit today, is if you go to college with a purpose, right? What is it that's interesting, that's intriguing, that's passionate, something that probably ideally has some sort of a technical skill to it? I don't care whether that's, you know, whether that's economics or mathematics or medical, you know, the medical field, something. You're learning something that's very specialized. The people that I feel bad for are the people that get these very generic educations. And I know as an employer, I see people applying for jobs in droves that have degrees in very generic liberal arts fields. And they're smart people, but there's a lot. It's very watered down. And maybe if some of those would have taken a different route and learned sort of a technical skill or something that that could be differentiate themselves, they would be a little more marketable.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a great point. I think investing into your interests is a great takeaway for those people listening. You know, I always say, look at colleges. The first 2 years are dedicated to prereqs you're taking, classes such as anthropology, and you're having to choose within certain selection of options versus taking those first 2 years of college and allowing students to try anything they want and pick courses and industries that may spark their interest. That way you're not 2 years out and you have students entering into their junior and senior year trying to figure out what they want to do still.
I agree with that. I always tell people, you know, follow your passion, not the money. And if there's anything that you love doing and you do it well, then you're probably going to be one of the best in the world at doing it. And if you're the best in the world at doing it, there's going to be a lot of ways to monetize it and the money will find you. So chase your passion, don't chase the money.
So you take this class, you find your passion, you finish up. What's kind of the next step in your journey here?
Yeah, I found a job about 2 weeks before I graduated. It was the other thing about being a field that people didn't know a lot about and not being as sexy is there was no problem getting a job. There were employers coming to the school, you know. So I accepted a job before I graduated, and I went to work in a place that did tool and die, making metal stamping dies, plastic injection molds, the mold plastic part, as well as aerospace machining. It was pretty, making parts for airplanes and missiles, things like that. So it was a pretty diverse opportunity to start with stamping dies, injection molds, and machining parts for airplanes. So great place to start my career. And again, this was in the 80s when computerized machines, we call them CNC, computer numerical control, were just coming along. And the shop had just won this contract from Ford Motor Company that was going to be the first all-digital car project. So no paper was going to be produced. So the company I was working for purchased a computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing computer system and some machines that were computer-controlled. And I was probably 19 years old at the time, 20 years old, just out of school, trade school. And the owner of the business said, "Hey, do you know anything about computers?" And I was like, "Not really." But he said, "Do you want to learn? Because I've got a lot of older guys here that think that computers are a fad, they're not going to catch on." And I said, "Absolutely." Next thing I know, I'm sitting in Detroit at Ford Motor Company with a bunch of engineers discussing the first all-digital car project, and I came back with a suitcase of reel-to-reel tapes that had sections of a car on it that when I got back, I loaded them up in our new computer and had all these components that we produced metal stamping dies and some molds for to make parts for a car. It was a great introduction to digital. I got to see how how it evolved, being there at the very beginning, and it really set myself up for an interesting career in manufacturing, making a challenge, and in combining digital with it.
So when your boss comes up to you and says, "Do you want to give this a shot?" It sounds like there was no hesitation. You were definitely up for this.
No, I had no hesitation because what I was doing, I was starting to regret my career choice, honestly, because I was doing a lot of manual type of manufacturing work. I was, everything from unloading the steel off the trucks, cutting it in pieces, running, manual machines where you're turning handles all day long. And I was thinking, man, maybe not going to college was a bad choice. So I did that for about a year before this opportunity came along. And, looking back, I needed that year of really, really hard, manual, dirty work to be able to appreciate and understand what was to come.
So when opportunities or moments such as the one you had are presented to a young person starting out that may not be their exact position or vision within that company, but is going to show them at least a different side of the business, a different way of operating, do you recommend they take it? Do they assess it? What's your thoughts?
Well, I think it depends on if it's a company and an industry they want to be in. If it is, get on the ground floor, even if it's something below your, what you think is below your education level, maybe even your salary level, et cetera. Because the best way to excel in any industry is to build domain expertise. And you can't really be a good leader one day or even a very valued team player if you haven't walked in the shoes of all the ranks of the company and done the jobs and experienced the customer's pain, dealt with customers. And so I absolutely think you need to get varied experiences, and some of them you might not consider pleasant, but there are people that make a career out of that because they don't have any other choice. You don't necessarily want to be one of those, but you want to have that experience.
So now you've come back from Ford. You're learning the different areas and aspects of manual and digital manufacturing. Where do you go from here?
Yeah, sorry about that. That turned into a great catalyst for me, and a lot of recruiters started to take notice because I was one of the few people that had that skill set early on. And I was asked to go for an interview at Northwest Airlines, and I was, wasn't sure what I would do at an airline, but I went for the interview, and what I found out was at this point in time, they had a lot of older airplanes that weren't well supported by the aircraft manufacturers, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas at the time. And when they needed parts for the airplanes, they'd have to wait sometimes 6 weeks, 3 months to get a part, which means an airplane is sitting on the ramp not generating revenue. And they said, "We want to take this into our own hands. If we can't find the part, we want a guy like you that we can reverse engineer the part, manufacture it, put it on the airplane, and get it back generating revenue, and that's valuable." And so that sounded really interesting to me. It paid a lot more than I was making at the small company I was working for. So I went to the airline and started up a rapid manufacturing cell, if you will, and built that up. And in the course of that, got a couple of patents. I got two patents on other things that for inspection of jet engines, and because from that role, it allowed me to I got a reputation for a guy that just got things done. And So I've just sort of got other projects within the company, and eventually moved into aircraft acquisitions. Eastern Airlines went out of business, and Northwest wanted to pick up some of the routes. I became a project manager at aircraft acquisitions and led buying a bunch of airplanes and overseeing the overhaul of those. Big departure from my manufacturing roots, but it was somewhat technical and leadership oriented. And then became a director of engineering, running a large section of the airline on the technical operations side.
So did you always see yourself as a leader or managing people? Did you ever have dreams of growing a company from the start? Or did you build up that confidence over time with the experiences you had? You know, was that a mindset that you always had, or did it shift at a certain point?
Yeah, definitely. I never saw that. I had never thought about myself as being a CEO, as being a leader. I always thought of myself as being a doer. And I think that naturally led to those types of roles, you know, because doers rise to the top. And yeah, but it wasn't something that I had visualized in my career. I'd never thought about it being CEO. And you know, even fast forwarding, I've never actually enjoyed the CEO job, even though I've had it, you know, a number of times.
A lot of people talk about doing. However, very few people actually execute. For those who execute and do so successfully a number of times, do you feel like those people end up in the role of being a leader or CEO because either A, somebody is going to ask them to be there, or B, they're just going to naturally transition and grow into that role?
Yeah, you know, it's a great point. And one of the things I think my parents instilled in me, my father was in the construction business for as long as I can remember, since, you know, I was a little toddler, I guess. And so I grew up with a family that was entrepreneurial and in business for themselves. And one of the things that I learned, right, I didn't realize I learned it, but one of my employers, when I was working actually early in that machine shop after trade school, the owner said to me, "One of the things I love about you is you have owner mentality." And I had never heard that word before. And he said, you act around here and you make decisions as if you were the owner. And I love that. And so it just sort of stuck with me that every owner, every, you know, one owns a business, they want their employees to have owner mentality. What would you do if you owned this place? How would you act? How would you treat the resources? What decisions would you make?
I think that's something extremely valuable for people to take away from this. You know, a number of times people work for a company or a group and they say, "I work for them," without realizing that they're a big part, they're a key piece to the puzzle. And that leads to company success. And those individuals, their hard work, treating it like it's their own, people recognize that, especially CEOs.
They recognize that, value it, and that will just lead to more and more opportunity. Every CEO, every owner wants a group of people that have owner mentality, and they will treat those people so well. And I will say, among my group of entrepreneur friends, I would say I think every one of us has that in common. You know, we didn't just act like an owner when we got our own business. We acted like an owner when we worked for someone else, and we treated their business as if it was our own.
At this point in your career, you've done some pretty amazing things. You've secured patents. You've been involved in acquisitions. You've really diversified your skill sets. Now what happens after this?
Yeah, so I got myself to a really good place at the airline. I'm making a great salary. I'm pretty proud of the guy that didn't go to college. I'm running a big organization, a global airline. And I had this opportunity, it was another recruiter call, to start a business selling software for the CAD, the 3D CAD software and CAM software, which is computer-aided manufacturing. It's used to take the CAD and program the machines that make what's in the CAD. And so they called me and said, "Hey, would you like to start up a dealership selling the software?" And I said, "I'm not that interested. I got a great," that was years ago. Now I'm an executive at an airline. And they said, "Well, we're going to go ahead and send a package down to you with just some of the highlights." So they sent down this package to me with some data in it. And what I realized was a couple of the major brands of the software at the time, and they had a couple of dealers throughout the South, from the Carolinas to Texas, and they were looking to create a mega dealer and got to get rid of the mom and pop dealers. And they had about 2,000 customers among all those dealers that they were going to roll into the mega dealer, which they were, you know, wanting to talk to me about. And those 2,000 customers were on software maintenance, paying about $1,000 a year each. So I quickly calculated that was $2 million. And I saw they were offering 50% margins to the dealer. So I said, well, wait a minute. So now I have an opportunity to start a business, you know, with $2 million in revenue and $1 million to run it off of. That's a pretty unique opportunity. And so they had sought me out because of the hands-on manufacturing experience, the leadership experience I had gained, et cetera. So I quit the job at the airline, bought a notebook computer, and inherited 2,000 customers. And that was the founding of a company called 3Datum.
In this case, it's not necessarily a huge risk, but you see the numbers and the potential opportunity ahead of you. How often do you think people are presented with similar opportunities such as this? Maybe not to this level or as clear, but something that is a stepping stone or that can lead to the growth in their life journey. And they don't take it or they let it pass by because they're comfortable. The job they have may be easy in the sense that they know, they feel they're financially secure. They don't want change. How many times do you think people miss or pass up these type of opportunities?
So I every single day. And I'll say it's clear as I talk about it in retrospect. At the time, it wasn't very clear. Right? Because I think I'm leaving a great job with a great salary and health benefits and flight benefits. And there's no guarantee those customers are going to renew that with me. The dealers are going to, if they're canceling, are going to rebel. They're going to try to switch them to another software package. So there was risk involved in it, right? So it wasn't clear cut, but it was a good opportunity. But I think, you know, in order to take that leap from leaving a really good executive job at an airline to go start up a mom and pop dealership selling software was a pretty big leap at the time. And I remember the way that I rationalized. I just kept thinking about it, and I really believed in my skills as an executive at the time. And I felt like I'm going to try this. Worst that can happen is I just got to go back and get a job again. And I'll probably be better for the experience having done that, right? Maybe I'll be a little more in debt. Maybe I have to file bankruptcy. I don't know. But I didn't want to be that guy sitting in the bar one time and say, coulda, wish I shoulda. I'd rather be the guy saying, man, I tried it and got my ass kicked, but at least I tried it.
So you eventually agree to take on this company. Where do you go from here?
Then I am scurrying like crazy to meet all these customers, make sure that they know me, that I'm adding value. I want to figure out what they need over and above just selling them a maintenance to upgrade their software every year. So I'm traveling from Carolinas to Texas and just having little events, and I'm meeting these guys. And so after about 18 months of doing that, I start to notice this theme. Like I go and I have these training sessions. I'm telling them tips and tricks about the software. And I notice my customers, they're designing things, are off in the corner with my manufacturing customers. And they're looking at designs and they're saying, hey, can you get me a price on this? And it turned into like networking events almost. And then fast forward that a little bit later, a few months later, one of my manufacturing customers called me and said, hey, I've got this new, was a design customer. I've got this new design and I need somebody to make it. Well, one of my manufacturing customers had just told me they needed some more work. So I said, let's get together for lunch. I'll introduce you guys. So I did. They hit it off. They're going to get pricing together and work together. I was driving out of the parking lot in 1999 and heard this commercial for LendingTree.com. Request your mortgage and let lenders compete. And I was like, holy smoke, that was a eureka moment for me. I said, what if I wanted something manufactured and I wanted manufacturers to compete? And I went home, and that was on a Thursday. And on Monday, I launched a website called MFG.com. At that point, it was called manufacturingquote.com, spelled out. And I wrote it over the weekend. And just Perl had a flat file database, and it was just some form handling. And I didn't think it was a business. I launched it from my thinking it was a way for me to add value to my software customers over and above selling them a subscription. I was going to create this marketplace for them to interact, and I didn't see that as a revenue generator. And so I launched that. And people, I sent an email out to my 2,000 customers. They start using it, requesting quotes, and my manufacturing customers providing quotes online. since I didn't have a lot of database skills, so I had used a flat file database. And so one of the things that I noted, was how I knew it started to take off, was I started seeing all the fields in the wrong place. Because, you know, if you enter a comma in a flat file, that is like in the next, you know, the next field. So when people would enter their company name or something, when they would register, they'd put a comma. And I spent my whole day opening that thing in Notepad, taking the commas out. And, you know, if I fast forward that about 6 months from then, people started hearing about it. Press started writing about this marketplace for manufacturing. And I started getting people calling me that weren't my software customer saying, can I join your marketplace? And I said, well, I guess so. What about, you know, $1,000? People start sending me checks. And then it starts coming from all over the world. And before I knew it, I had built a marketplace for the world's manufacturing industry.
So the company you're previously at selling software, how long do you stay there before either looking to sell or changing your career trajectory?
Yeah, so that business continued on for about another year after I had the marketplace up and running. And it's a very interesting financing strategy here, because when I started building the manufacturing marketplace, I started building MFG.com. Those were the days you had to buy your own servers and backup devices and firewalls. So it took a lot of cash. And I was bootstrapping this thing, and I didn't raise any money. I didn't have a plan to. I didn't know how to. And things were moving so fast, I didn't have the time to divert to raising money. So I financed it the old-fashioned way. I maxed out 8 credit cards. I got a second mortgage on the house, cashed in my 401k. And then the final thing was, when I would, for my software reseller business, when I would sell that software, I would collect 100% of the money, and I would pay 50% to the people that made the software. Well, I started extending out that payable, living off of that cash, as long as they would let me, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. So I was using that cash to fund the marketplace. So finally, I got to the point where they were becoming intolerant, and like, you really got to pay this bill. So I found another dealer up in the Michigan area, had Michigan, Ohio, that was interested in my business in the South. And I said, tell you what, I'll sell you this business for, I think it was $200,000, and you take the debt that I had run up with them and pay off that payable. So I had creatively used that for funding, and he bought the business for $200,000 plus paid off the payable.
So now you do all this, you're bootstrapping MFG. At this point, a lot of people these days, especially in the tech world, as we've seen the growth and explosion of social apps and platforms, they say, I need an investment, I need a fund, I need seed money, I need someone to back me. Very rarely do you ever have anyone say, I'm going to take on the risk myself. Do you feel there is a pro versus doing it yourself versus looking for outside money, for the fact that when it's your own money, you're maxing out credit cards, putting up mortgages, you have no choice but to succeed?
You're exactly right. You have no choice but to succeed. Lots of stories and things along that line. When you're spending your money, it forces you to focus. Focus like a freaking laser. Make sure every movement that you make is something that matters. Make sure everything that you do for customers is something that they value. It makes you love your customers. And so I am a really big advocate of bootstrapping, get the business off the ground, get it to revenue. And believe me, if you want to, you can find a way to do that. You can find a way to do that. And so I often tell entrepreneurs, you know, once you get a business to some sort of revenue and you have proven that, one, you've got that tenacity, and two, the customers value enough of what you're building or selling that they'll pay you money for it, it's easy to get money at that point, because now you're not talking about backing a theory. You're talking about backing a business that has already proven that customers will buy what it sells and that you know how to deliver that. Now the money is just for scaling, and anyone will invest in scaling, and you can get a really good valuation for that.
That's a great point. Now that you've moved on from 3Datum, your focus and main priority is MFG.com. So now that you have laser focus and are solely invested into this, this started in 2000. So now you're up and running, and it's only been 6 months when you start getting calls from around the world, all organic, no marketing, as you've really filled a void in this space. So then where does it all start to go from there?
Yeah, so then it starts to take on a life of its own. Like, revenue is coming in nicely. but so are expenses. Because I'm having to build out infrastructure. I'm having to add programmers. I have to add database people, customer service, salespeople. And so it's revenue is growing nicely. It's also consuming cash. So that was a really great learning experience, learning how to manage that. You know, taking relatively low salary myself, I went from a, you know, a six-figure salary at the airline to about, I think, $60,000 a year running the marketplace and going in debt, right? And so did that. That took about 4 years before we really crossed that curve where I had enough of the infrastructure in place and the business had grown enough to support the people that I needed. And so 2004, I think, was when it really turned the corner to significant profitability. I started to make some money. But there was 4 years where it was pretty tough and a lot of challenging times in there. Quick story. I remember once, it was in 2003, the business was going great, but there were cash challenges because of the growth. And I remember one night waking up and thinking I was having a heart attack. And I told my wife, I said, I got to go to the hospital. I'm having a heart attack. We need to call 911. She starts, so they'll just drive me. So we drive to the hospital. And they're like, you're not having a heart attack. And I thought, well, are you stressed about anything? And I, well, maybe the fact that it's Tuesday and payroll is due on Friday and I'm $25,000 short. I don't know where that's coming from. And they said, well, it's anxiety. You're not having a heart attack. And those are things that, you know, are really, really tough moments to deal with because you don't know how you're going to do it, but you find a way at the end of the day.
How many times during 2000 through 2004 did you think about quitting or giving up, if at all?
Yeah, I never thought about quit. I never thought about quitting or giving up. I never did. But boy, the things that drove me, I think at that point, the reason I couldn't quit and give up was the moment that I hired my first person, it was a whole nother, like, now it was like, they've got a family. They're depending on me. I can't let them down. And the minute that I took money from a customer, that was like a driving moment for me. They believe in me. They paid me. I have got to deliver exceptionally. And so it's interesting that once I started taking money and hiring employees, the pressure really went up on me. Not that quitting was not an option.
I recall a conversation you and I actually had years ago when I was launching my current agency, Premier, about business plans. And I said, I never wrote a business plan when I started the agency. I just kind of did and learned as I went and really figured it out. And I remember you said you never wrote a business plan. And I asked why. And I vividly remember you saying, everyone writes a business plan with a straight trajectory. And in life, nothing goes exactly according to plan. So if you don't have a plan in place and if things go left or right, you don't necessarily realize you're off track because you're figuring it out as it kind of happens.
Yeah, that's right. You can, because nothing goes linear, right? Things are going to happen. Opportunities are going to come along. And so I think, it depends on the business. I mean, if you're going to go out and you're going to raise money from venture capital, you got to have a business plan in order to just – part of that is just to prove that you've thought it out, right? But if you're starting off on your own journey and you're going to self-finance and you're going to bootstrap it, you want to have tried to think it through, but you don't need to spend the time to put it on paper for yourself, right?
So in 2004, you turn a corner, business is booming. So what happens now?
Yeah, 2004, we turn the corner, things start to look good, starting to make money, and 2005, people start to take notice. I get a call from a large public company that says, hey, this is very interesting. We'd like to talk about partnering. I'm like, sure. They come to visit. Soon thereafter, they made an acquisition offer. And I think that was in the realm of $11 million, which was a lot of money to me. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Okay, I'll do it. We went through about 6 months of due diligence and contracts and integration planning, and they were very excited. And then we were about 2 weeks away from closing that, and I received another call from a guy that worked for Jeff Bezos, you know, the Amazon founder, and he said, hey, I work for Jeff Bezos. Jeff would like to meet you. Do you think you're going to be near Seattle? If not, I'll arrange a phone call. And I'm like, well, absolutely, I'm going to be near Seattle. So, yeah. So, and I actually did have a reason to be out there, but I was out there, a week or so later, and went by and had a meeting with Jeff, and he was just fascinated with the business and the marketplace and how I had started it and bootstrapped it. And I remember that went from, a little over an hour, and then Jeff left. He said, "Hey, great meeting you." And I said, "Hey, can I get a picture?" Because I'm thinking I'll never see this guy again. And I wasn't sure why we actually had the meeting, but the Pope of the Internet calls, you go, right? Yeah. And go back to my hotel, and this woman that worked for him called me and said, "Hey, Jeff wants to be an investor in your business. Did you guys talk about terms?" And I'm like, "No, it never came up." And I said, "That's actually flattering, but, I don't really need an investor. Tell Jeff, thank you very much." And the reason is I was selling to that public company. We were just a couple of weeks away from closing. And she called back, and Jeff said, "Well, he's not taking no for an answer. We should get you an offer." And she said, "Can I call your CFO and get some numbers, and we'll send an offer over?" So they did. They sent over an offer to invest. So I think it was $1 million, a relatively small amount of money, and it was generous terms. And I said, "Thank you very much, but I'm just not inclined to do it." The reason: I'm under NDA again with a public company. I'm not even supposed to say that they're acquiring us. Well, they called back and they sweetened that offer. Again, they raised the valuation and put more money. And I said, I'm very honored, but not in the cards right now." But then Jeff called me and said, "I'm clearing my calendar for the moment here. Why don't you want to be in business with me?" He said, "I love your story. I love that you've bootstrapped it. I love that you understand this manufacturing industry from the ground up, getting your hands dirty in it from day one. And you're uniquely prepared at the right moment in time. And I see these perfect storms when they happen. And this is one of them. And I think I can help you." And he said, "So why don't you want to be in business with me?" And at that point, I came clean. I said, "Hey, I'm selling the company. I got closing in 2 weeks." He said, "No. If you really want to do that, I'll buy the company and pay you $5 million, and they're paying you whatever it is they're paying you, and I'll hire you to run it. But I don't think you want to do that. This company is still embryonic. It's a lot of growth left. Right? Why would you sell it now?" And I said, "Well, because I've been taking a small salary. I got a lot of debt to pay off from my credit cards. I got the second mortgage. I cashed in the 401k. And this is more money than I thought I'd ever see in my life." And he goes, "So fine, let's take care of that. Let's strike a deal where I'll buy some of the equity, allow you to take money off the table, put it in your bank account that frees up your financial needs, and put some money in the company to help you continue to grow it. And then you can grow it." He said, "Because I think an entrepreneur, once you've taken care of their financial needs, their mind becomes even freer. Now they can grow the business without being in a defensive position." So I said, "Well, there's one other thing, and that is my employees. They all know they're cashing in their stock options in 2 weeks, and they've all been out car shopping and house shopping, and I got 38 employees at the time. And they're, if I decide not to do that deal, then I'm gonna have mutiny on my hands." Right? And Jeff said, "That's why I want to be in business with you, because you think about your employees, you think about it." And so he ended up chipping in $2 million of his own money that he did not get equity for, just for me to have a party to hand out to those 38 people to compensate them for the money they would have gotten from their stock options.
Wow.
Yeah, what a great guy Jeff Bezos is.
Wow, that's truly amazing. That really shows his character. And for me, what that really signifies is it shows that when you get like-minded people together, it's not always so much about the money as much as it is about doing what's right, and good things will come. And investing into those who invest into you.
Yeah, so I backed out of the contract with the public company, which wasn't an easy thing to do.
How did that go?
I could probably talk about it now, it's years later. But I called my lawyers first, and they said, "Go with seller's remorse."
Yeah.
And I went with seller's remorse, and I called up the company and said, "Look, myself and my team love you guys, but we just don't think we're a good cultural fit. We don't think we want to come work for your company, and I think we should, I wanted to bring that to the surface. We think we want to continue being entrepreneurial and scrappy, And we think if we come under your big corporate umbrella, it's going to really mess up the vibe. And you may not be happy with the value that you get. And what do you want to do? And they thought it was a negotiations employee and offered to pay me more money. And I said, it wasn't about the money. It was about, you know. And then so they said, fine, if you guys don't want to join us and you don't think you'd fit, then thanks for telling us and we'll rescind our offer.
The one thing that you mentioned was company culture. And to me, I feel that's a huge part of businesses today. You're seeing more and more people taking jobs for less money to have a better work-life balance, company culture, atmosphere, really coming into work every day and truly enjoying being around that environment and those people. How much of a role did the company culture play in the success of MFG?
Oh, it was huge. That was huge. Well, you can't do these Herculean entrepreneurial feats without a team of people that are as passionate about it as you are. And the only way that happens is with a good culture, right? Because smart people have a lot of choices. They can work a lot of places and do a lot of things. And so they have to. You have to create something that they believe in, where they believe that the mission that they're on is bigger than life. It's bigger than the job, bigger than the salary, and pay attention to the chemistry. And then you got to be decisive when you get that one person that is cancerous to the organization, because that cancer will infect everyone, will infect the culture, and you have to cut it out quick.
So now you get Jeff involved. He believes in you. I'm sure at this point your confidence must be even greater to have a person like Jeff Bezos say, I believe in what you're doing. Where do you go from here? Because at this point, the growth is pretty significant.
Yeah, well, yeah. As I relayed earlier, I think, you know, being driven by employees as a motivator, that I don't want to let them down. Don't want to let down customers. Well, think about taking money from Jeff Bezos. Now, all of a sudden, that became a massive motivator.
I'm sure.
Right?
A lot more sleepless nights.
A lot more sleepless nights. Because, you know, the way I'm wired, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are, is not to let other people down. Right? And so I thought, well, Jeff Bezos believed in me. He put his money behind me. He changed my life financially. I cannot let this guy down. And I think having something like that, having someone like that, really was a driver and a motivator to me to make sure that I wanted to show him that his faith in me was well placed, that his investment in my company was a good investment, and that became a really big driver.
I'm sure. At this point, you've expanded and have clients now in over 50 countries. You have multiple offices. You're offering the platform in multiple languages. As this business starts to scale and becomes the monster it is, how do you manage all of that? And when do you hit a pinnacle here of an unbelievable amount of success?
So I use the investment from Jeff, and then following him was another investment from a venture capital firm who was, for lack of a better term, they were Bezos chasing. This was in 2007, and they came in and made an investment, and they sort of had the thesis, if Jeff Bezos invested in it, then it must be good. And they invested in it in 2007. I didn't need the capital. I'd just taken money from Jeff. And they were pretty insistent, kept raising their offer, and they invested at a crazy valuation. They overpaid. And then 2008 hit, and the market crashes, and they really overpaid. So I had a lot of cash in the bank to run the business off of from that. And then that just led to a global expansion. I did an acquisition in Europe, opened up an entity, an office from scratch in Shanghai, China, which had a couple hundred employees eventually serving Southeast Asia. So we had Europe, North America, and Asia well covered, connecting the world's manufacturing economy. And fast forward that, got a pretty big revenue, pretty big business. And as I said, I've never really enjoyed or felt comfortable in the CEO role. I like more getting my hands dirty and doing. And when you get to a certain point, the CEO role becomes a lot of managing the board, managing the finances. And so I ultimately hired someone to come in as president, but not CEO. Jeff, I talked with Jeff Bezos about that, and Jeff said, I don't want you giving up the CEO role. I think that'll really mess up the culture if you do that. But bring in someone as president. So I did, and then gave them some leeway. That ultimately, didn't turn out to be the best decision, because I went for someone with a really, you know, great education, great corporate background, but came in with a lot of experience that was counter to an entrepreneurial environment. So I think I made a bad hire there. Went through some money pretty quick. Revenues fell, and ultimately I had to terminate that person, step back in, and fix things back up myself. So maybe I'm not the best at scaling or hiring in that regard, but it was a great learning experience of what a bad hire can do.
As you mentioned earlier, you like to put your head down and get your hands dirty, and you've never really been comfortable with the CEO role. However, do you feel like that head-down mentality was the reason you were able to grow MFG to the world's largest global online manufacturing marketplace?
Yeah, it absolutely is, because I was so connected to the market dynamics, the customer, what the customers needed, that I think, because, I mean, I wasn't the only person creating a marketplace for the manufacturing industry at the time. And the other folks were very well-funded, very great pedigrees. But they had never gotten their hands dirty. They had written a great thesis at business school. And so I was the little engine that could, that knew exactly, you know, how the industry worked, had the right vernacular, the right domain expertise, and was able to just outmaneuver a lot of well-funded companies with no funding.
So now you grow, you make this bad hire, it doesn't work out, you end up losing some money, some market share, and you end up having to step back in. How long do you stay in that role? What happens with MFG at this point?
Get the ship corrected, headed back in the right direction, have to do a little bit of downsizing from where, you know, that's one of the challenges when you take in a lot of investment money, right? You grow because you have the money, because you're expected to grow. So you add staff, you add offices, you add products, you add things. Not necessarily because the market is demanding them in lockstep, because you're anticipating, because you have a lot of cash in the bank and you're being pushed by your investors to find growth opportunities. And I think we were a victim of that. We were a lot more, before we had so much cash, we were more nimble, more thoughtful. And so I tried to put some of that discipline back into the business once I got rid of some of the management team that we had hired to help scale. And a lot of that management team had been brought in by or suggested by the VCs, which was people that probably had been had relationships with them for years. And great, very smart people. I can't say anything derogatory about them. They just weren't right for an entrepreneurial scaling company. They were right for running a big global organization. So got that ship righted. And then I had annual medical physical, was in great shape, and found out I had cancer. So I decided then it wasn't a good fit for me to continue running a business. I, you know, when you hear the word that you have cancer, you bad things go through your head. And so I stepped away from the business totally and said, I just want to step away after 13 years of running the business and focus on my health. And all turned out well. It was colon cancer, and I was fortunate that I caught it in time, and all is well today.
First, just let me say, I'm so glad to hear you're doing well and overcame it. I know at this point you've had quite a journey. You know, you've run successful businesses. You've overcome cancer, as you just mentioned. Lots of ups and downs, but more so ups, which is great. So your first company gets acquired. You grow your second company to be the largest global marketplace for manufacturing. Many people at this point would just kind of fall back on their accomplishments and slow down a bit, hang out, relax. However, you do the complete opposite. You decide, I'll take off a little bit of time and then launch two companies. Not one, but two. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah. So the first one is a company called Zyci, Z-Y-C-I, that does CNC machining. And that's back to my roots. I've been always loved making things. Now, when I started Zyci, I didn't actually think that it was going to be a business. I want to buy a CNC machine. I want to make some parts. I want to get my hands dirty again. And I thought, this is going to lead me to what my next business will be. If I get my hands dirty again, if I reconnect with my roots, with the experience that I've gained, I'm going to spot inefficiencies in the market, a software tool that's missing, something that will spawn this next great idea. So I thought, I'm going to buy this machine. I'm going to do some playing around, some hobbies, and maybe do a little bit of inventing. So I buy it. And then people that knew me from the manufacturing industry start, hey, can you make these parts for me and do it kind of quickly? I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll knock those out for you. So I made those. Well, long story short, start hiring people, buying more machines, and I'm in the CNC machining business, which actually turned out to be a really good business because that skill set has really degraded in America. And it's just hard to find companies that do it well, do it fast. And so we're 3.5 years into that business now. And we do tier one flight hardware for rocket companies. I'm not allowed to say their name, based on the West Coast. We do a lot of work for the Department of Defense. We make components for medical devices. We're making parts for a thing called the solar probe, which goes up to the sun, takes a specimen and come back. So everything from jump ropes that we make all the way through in a very interesting spacecraft. And I am having the time of my life because it's very tangible.
Yeah.
And one of the things that crossed my mind in this business was I was thinking of going into another software as a service business, another technology business. But that's gotten to be a pretty easy business, right? It's very easy now with everything being cloud-based and so much open-source software. It's low barrier to entry with anything that's software as a service today. And I think the next wave of wealth creation that we're in is back to the making things, back to the new industrial revolution. And I think that's where our next wave of billionaires and wealth creation is going to come from. It's from making physical things or software as a service type business that leverages traditional assets in a way, such as what Uber is doing, right? Uber is taking assets that were out there, but organizing them in a way that makes them more accessible. And I think those are the real opportunities right now, is organizing assets in a way that makes them more accessible or making physical or enabling physical things to be made.
For companies such as Zeeky or Uber, as you had referenced, these companies not only originated from a passion, but for a purpose. Things that have a purpose and passion behind it always seem to rise to the top. I mean, here you are, you're going back to your roots, something that made you want to be involved in this particular business and industry. To those looking in from the outside, it's not seen as the sexiest business, but behind the scenes, you're working with some of the coolest brands and companies in the world at the moment, and I feel like people may not understand or really know about that side of the manufacturing business. They may think it's a mundane, it's unglamorous, you simply put it in a machine, let it go, and it creates a part. I don't think they necessarily realize the full scope of how intricate and interesting the space is. Do you agree?
Yeah, manufacturing today is very tech-enabled. You know, you're taking 3D computer models that engineers are generating. You're simulating the manufacturing on the screen, so almost like a video game style, outputting code that goes in a machine that you set up that then cuts that material. It's very clean. It's high-tech. You have to understand software. You need to know geometry, math, and it is just amazing the level of precision. I mean, we're constantly working to tolerances and precision levels that were, if you took a human hair and split it 10 times, that we're constantly, that's the accuracy of which we have to be on a lot of the things that we make.
So within the space of manufacturing right now, when you started Zeeky, for instance, the company grows, you need to hire employees. What does the landscape look like right now as far as people that are in the space that are available for hire, that have the skill sets to do this? Is there a need for it? Is there a lack of it?
There's a tremendous need for it. There is a tremendous skill shortage. If you were to come over and walk through my shop, the average age is between 55 and 65. And what happened was when a lot of the manufacturing work went off to Asia, when China opened up its economy and people started sending manufacturing work there to take advantage of low-cost labor, factories just shut down all across America. And there wasn't a need for people. So trade schools shut down their programs because nobody was going into them. And so we skipped a whole generation that has this manufacturing expertise. And we're struggling with that as an industry. And so for those folks that, you know, think they want to be an engineer or have some mechanical aptitude but like getting their hands dirty, Manufacturing is an incredible career opportunity. It pays well. It's easy to get a job if you have got the right, you know, the right skill set. And yeah, highly encourage that career path.
So for those individuals who are interested in getting involved or learning more about it, what do you recommend they do? Do they go knock on some doors? Do they read certain publications? Where do they gather that information just to kind of get started?
Yeah, I think, you know, depending on where you live, just find somebody that's in, it's in the business of, you know, let's say CNC machining, for example. Just look them up online, just, you know, just Google and go and just go visit or call them up and ask if you can come visit, take a tour, just see what it's all about. Talk to some of the people. And if it looks like it's something that fits your interest, just talk to the owner or whoever's in charge and say, this is something I'm interested in. How could I get my foot in the door here? And I think, you know, myself and a lot of the owners I know of similar businesses, we're looking for people that have that passion, because we have to create the next generation of manufacturing workers. And as you said, this is not what comes up in people's minds. It's not sparks flying press, you know, punch presses going up and down. This is high technology, high precision, clean work that's really, really interesting. And so I would say, you know, if you have an interest, go visit. Just talk to some people. Tell them you're interested. Tell them you want in on the ground floor. This is probably an instance where you got to start off on the ground floor doing some really crappy jobs. But over the period of a couple of years, you'll work yourself into a really good spot.
So now that we've talked a little bit about Zeeky, and now I would like to jump to your other venture, one of the two that you've been involved with here in the last 2 years, Fast Radius. And if you want to tell us a little bit more about that company and how it happens to differ from Zeeky.
Yeah, so Zeeky, on the CNC machining side, we're taking pieces, you know, chunks of metal or plastic, and we're removing material from cutting away metal to make it into a shape. And so we call it, that's subtractive manufacturing. We're subtracting metal to make it into what we want to make it into. So Fast Radius is additive manufacturing. It's the opposite. So we're and a lot of people in the layman's terms would know this as 3D printing. In the industrial world, we call it additive manufacturing. So we're making parts and components out of plastic and metal by adding material in order to build it up rather than subtracting by taking it away. So Fast Radius is an additive manufacturing business. And so I saw that coming along, and I hadn't intended for it to be different from Zeeky. But the reason it is different is I do have some investors in that business, Fast Radius. Now, the thesis was I wanted to be able to print parts until as late in the day as possible and still get them to people for early morning delivery. And in order to capitalize on next day premiums, you need a replacement part for something, or you want to move toward digital virtual inventory where you are a product company, but you don't actually have your parts in stock. We make them on demand. I wanted to set up that sort of a structure. And in the researching and setting up that business, I found a really good partner in UPS. You know, UPS, the people, everybody knows them for brown trucks, but they're a lot more than that. They're a logistics and supply chain company, and they totally got the vision of what you know, digital is going to do to manufacturing, and especially as additive manufacturing progresses. And I had this vision of setting up a global manufacturing cloud, analogous to what Amazon did with EC2 and the Elastic Computing Cloud. And so we're in the process of setting up additive manufacturing facilities at the UPS hubs all around the world. So rather than having things in physical inventory, we'll actually produce them on demand wherever in the world they're needed. And then it'll be a short leg for the delivery of those things.
In the span of your career, you've had a couple big companies and partners that have come on board and worked with you. What I find interesting about both of them is you never went out and seek them, which in a way proves if you focus on building a great product or service, people will take notice and eventually want to get involved, versus sometimes I feel like people may lead the cart before the horse. Like you had said earlier, you know, a lot of these people don't have a real business or anything viable to show, and they're going out and they're pitching these people, yet there's nothing to show in the way of metrics, revenue, or success.
Totally agree with you. So advice I give entrepreneurs is spend your time creating your product and getting customers to pay for it. Execute well, there are, with investment firms, with venture capitalists, private equity firms, there are people whose job is to find you. They are constantly scouring the market, looking, talking to people, looking for investment opportunities. You don't have to spend your time looking for them. And if you're doing something well, people will take notice, and the right investors will come calling. At least that's been my experience. I didn't go seek Jeff Bezos. I didn't go seek the other venture capitalist firm that invested. I didn't go seek UPS. So to execute well, and they will find you. And way too many entrepreneurs spend a lot of their time and effort chasing money, trying to get investor meetings, trying to pitch. And they should have spent that effort trying to get customers.
I really think that's important for people to hear and understand. The bottom line is just get shit done. We all talk about what we're going to do. Just go and do it. That's the message.
Yeah.
You noted earlier in this business that people will send things overseas and to other places. You see this and you realize that there's a void and decide instead of waiting for it to come to you, you're going to go out and do it. Get it yourself because you want to get it done. With that being said, one of the big discussions in our country and current landscape at the moment is how we bring manufacturing back to the U.S. What are your thoughts on it and how do you think we could go about doing that?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that we have to focus on is the talent and the skill set, right? Because let's say there was some government thing enacted where it was now not legal or not attractive to have your stuff made, overseas. What the hell are we going to do? No, but there's nobody here to do it. So that would be, it's kind of a crazy notion. Let's bring it all back to who, right? Because I can tell you, we already run at a very high capacity. Most every similar business I know is running at a very high capacity, right? I do very little, if any, marketing. I just don't need to, right? Customers find us because of the shortage. So if you were to wholesale bring back a ton of manufacturing to America, it's a great thought. It's a great political slogan. But there's not the factories or the people to do the job today. So I think first we have to focus on that. You got to get back. We're creating the skill set, right? And so I think that's job number one, and make it attractive again, right? Because when it became attractive, the best and the brightest. When it became unattractive manufacturing because it went overseas, then the best and the brightest went and did other things. They went and did investment banking. They became lawyers. They did stuff. And we've got to make it something where it's a wealth creator again. And then the best and the brightest will come back and begin to start up these digital factories for manufacturing, recruit the right talent, and make it interesting. But the way that wealth was created in America originally was through manufacturing, right? That was what created. And I think we're moving right back to that. Things go in cycles. I think we're moving right back where manufacturing is the next wealth creator once again.
What do you think is next for the industry?
Well, I think the awareness is starting to come back that this is an opportunity. I think there are a lot of smart people in this country that follow the money, follow the opportunity, and I think investment is going to be looking towards manufacturing. I think that will make people get interested, start to follow, start to learn the skills, the trade. But it's not going to be fast because it's not something that you can go take a 6-month course or a 1-year course and learn. You can get the basics, but it takes years to develop the skill and the craft. So we have to figure out how to do that. And some of that actually might involve incentivizing foreigners to come here and start a business in order for us to learn. Quick aside around talent and manufacturing. At one point, I had researched, it's so hard to find young talent in manufacturing. Well, where are they? They're in Asia. They're in places where manufacturing went. So I thought, well, maybe I can get some H-1Bs and bring some people over to help train other staff, some younger staff that I could hire. Well, to get an H-1B, you have to have an advanced degree in something that is, very unique and hard to find here, which is kind of BS because 90-something percent of the H-1Bs are issued to people with computer software skills. So that's kind of BS. We're importing people that have advanced degrees, but they're programmers, right? Which we have plenty of people in America that could fill that job. So I can't really get H-1Bs to bring over skilled manufacturing people because they don't have advanced degrees in the most part. They're people that went to trade school or something, self-educated, have great skills. Now, there is an exception to the H-1B rule I learned, and that is if you're a fashion model. So if you're a fashion model, you can get an H-1B, okay. Right? Well, I think we should think about one way to bring talent back into this country that helps train the next generation that we desperately need is perhaps open up an H-1B program to let people immigrate from certain countries, whether it be, you know, Taiwan or Malaysia or China or wherever, or Mexico, wherever the skills have gone, let those people come here and teach our next generation how to get those skills back.
I think that's actually a very interesting idea. So now you've learned a lot these past few years. You have some good insight, a track record of being an industry leader in this space. So in 2016, you co-authored a book along with Rick Smith called The Great Disruption, Competing and Surviving in Second Wave of the Industrial Revolution. Can you tell me more a little bit about the book and why you decided to write it and what you're really hoping people would get out of it?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I think that next, the wealth creation opportunity that's upon us right now is this new industrial revolution. And there is a disruption happening by some new digital technologies, particularly around additive manufacturing. For a long time, you know, additive manufacturing, 3D printing is not new. It was invented in 1988. But we're at this very interesting point where the maturation and some technologies have intersected that make it a very viable production candidate competing with traditional technologies like injection molding or metal casting. And I think there are some people that are going to really, really leverage that, not in a maker kind of way, but in an industrial way, right? Makers have been playing around with 3D printers and stuff, and that's fine and cool, and it's great for education. But the real money is in the industrial sector. Meeting needs of companies that are doing, you know, real stuff like medical devices and spacecraft and airplanes and stuff like that. So part of the reason for the book was just to try to inspire people and open their minds to the opportunity, because we need this as a country. We need a vibrant manufacturing sector because it creates jobs. It creates good paying jobs. It creates an infrastructure for logistics and shipping and raw material supply and everything that insurance, everything that businesses consume. And manufacturing has the possibility of being the greatest wealth creator in our country, not just for the owners, but by everyone that works for, participates, and supplies those businesses. So I saw the book as the opportunity to do my little part to help tell the story and open the eyes to the opportunity.
If there's one thing today after all we've covered and spoken about that you want listeners to walk away with, from not only this industry, but work and life in general, what would that be?
Yeah, just do what you enjoy. Do what you enjoy and do it well. Follow your passion. Don't follow the money. The money will find you if you follow your passion. Do it well. Don't necessarily follow like a sheep on the path that you think you're supposed to follow. And, you know, if college is right for you, do that. If college isn't right for you, don't do that. And be careful working jobs that, you don't think are a good fit for you and because of your passions. But do take jobs and opportunities that allow you to learn, allow you to get your hands dirty, allow you to see how the sausage is made. Those things pay huge dividends later in life when you want to move into leadership positions and you have an understanding of how everything works and you've walked in the path of the people that make the sausage and you've talked to customers and you know what makes them buy and what makes them happy and what makes them unhappy. That well-rounded experience is invaluable. And just persevere.
I think those are some great takeaways. As for yourself, anything new or exciting you're working on?
Oh, every day is an exciting day. Every day that I get to work with our customers in the manufacturing sector with Zeke and Fast Radius, and you know, I see the inventiveness of people and the new products they're creating, the new challenges that we're taking on, whether that be, you know, with space programs or whatever. And I'm just constantly amazed at the inventiveness, the creativity, that people have, and you know, as being a company that manufactures the things they come up with, I feel honored to be able to play a small part in bringing those things to life.
So if people want to get in touch with you or learn more about yourself, your companies, or the industry, how can they go about doing so?
Yeah, either website. So Zyci is ZYCI.com, Zebra Yankee Charlie India, ZYCI.com. And by the way, that name means nothing. It was just a four-letter domain name that I owned when I didn't think it was really going to be a business. Otherwise, I might have to pick something better. And then Fast Radius is just as it sounds, FastRadius.com. Either one of those, Zyci or FastRadius.com.
Mitch, I just want to thank you for your time today, man, and coming on the show. I truly appreciate it. I'm excited for people to hear your story and hopefully walk away with a new outlook, passion, and appreciation of the manufacturing industry and really understand how much of an impact it can make not only for the country, but for individuals and their futures. Yeah.
So to that point, we've got some awesome manufacturing is cool t-shirts. And if people want to contact us via Zyci.com and let us know they heard this podcast, I'll send them a manufacturing is cool t-shirt.
Do it now before they sell out. Mitch, once again, thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.